You're listening to Buildopedia, your go-to podcast for everything you need to know about property. By covering the entire journey from buying your home through to design, building, selling, and everything in between, we'll help you fill in the blanks and bring your property vision to life.
Welcome to the latest episode of Buildopedia. Our special guest today is Fane Levy. He's a seasoned finance professional. He's helped me out so many times and he's a trusted mortgage broker. Fane, welcome to Buildopedia.
Thank you very much. That's a nice warm introduction. Appreciate that. So happy to be here.
And my favorite story about Fane is, I mean, you've helped me on a number of deals, I guess, with banks. You've got me out of trouble a few times. But my favorite story is when I rang you once and you rang back and said, oh, I can't talk much because I'm in hospital. And I said, Fane, just call me back when you're out of hospital, maybe.
Yeah, you and a few other clients had that same conversation with me. It's very hard to relinquish control as such, you know, so did what I could.
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely the most committed mortgage broker or any person I've ever dealt with. You're there, you always phone back. You've got a phone message that says, I'll come back to you in, what is it, four business hours?
Two business hours.
And yeah, you're like clockwork. So yeah, very, very appreciative of everything you've helped me with over time. And you're senior credit advisor at Shore Financial, which is a mortgage broker. Is that a big, I don't know much about Shore Financial, but you've got a pretty mean podcast room. So you must.
Yeah, it is pretty mean. First time I'm using it. There's padded walls. We've got the brand in here, double mic, TV in front. So yeah, Shore Financial started 10 years ago. It's an independent brokerage and there's about 70 of us now in the company. That includes obviously brokers, support staff, operations, financial planners. We've got some offshore staff as well. We've got about 35 brokers. So yeah, it is quite a big operation. We're proud to say that we've won, I think, best independent brokerage maybe 6 or 7 years in a row, maybe even more. So yeah, it's great. Good company to work.
And I guess your role in that has checked because you've been there for a while. So at what point do you become a director, I wonder? Or like, what's your...
Question. I'm happy to bring the director in. Maybe we'll try squeeze an answer out of him live on this podcast. I'm not so certain. It's you grow with the team, your book grows. It's not to get into too much detail, but it's a commission-based role, so as your book grows, your commission splits get better and better. And once you reach a certain element, I guess it's worthwhile staying and not really starting your own thing or moving to another brokerage. So it is rewarding from that aspect.
And of course, I've neglected the script and jumped straight in. But I guess the reason we've got Fane here today is to really give us some insights, and that's what we've tried to really focus on with Buildopedia is the grungy underbelly and the inside information about, particularly in our case, about banks. Because I thought to myself, well, if you get someone from the bank, they're never going to really tell you how it is. So I'm hoping you're our insider.
Yeah, I'll spill the beans to you.
Spill the beans. Give us all a goss on how banks operate, how we can get a good deal out of them. That's kind of what I'm hoping to get out of today.
Definitely.
And normally we start, and I always forget this, but today I haven't. I guess we ask our guests who inspired them recently or in the last week or what inspired them, or it might be a book or something that you've read that you'd like to share. Have you got something like that?
Yeah, I don't have a book or somebody necessarily that inspired me, but more of something that was great that was achieved this week. And you'd appreciate this. Finally got to my outside timber decking, which has been grey for about 2 years, and I put it on and off, and then booked the guys in, and finally they came out this week to sand it, clean it, and then stain it and redo all the decking, and they're working right now as we're speaking. So I'm really looking forward to that being finished by the end of this week. That's definitely a nice accomplishment.
So we're going to have a barbie. What are we doing on the deck?
So I redid the barbecue area, so demolished it and built a nice off-form concrete barbecue 3 meters long with a curve in it, and then timber slats, a nice LED strip underneath. and then redid the fence behind and painted it white to give it a bit of a coastal Hamptons look. And now they're going to sand and stain the deck, hopefully a similar color to the timber slats in the actual barbecue. So it should all look really nice.
That is so fine. That is
so me. The light, that, the light.
That is
so. Color.
That is fine through and through. Like that's brilliant. I love it. So I guess we wanted to start with a little bit of a your background. How did you get in? Because I had this. I don't know if I should be sharing it, but I did get this. I don't know if it was a message or it was on stuck to your phone number, but you started selling shoes or something. There was something about shoes. Is it cooler, is that, or is it?
Yeah, of course.
So how did you get from shoes to like brokering deals with banks?
Yeah, well, it's a long story if we've got time. I was always a wheeler and dealer. So at school, I used to get my mum to make me 3 sandwiches, one for recess, one for lunch, and one to sell. And I was selling the sandwiches for $5 a pop. And, you know, as a 10, 11-year-old, that was great, making 20, 30 bucks a week or whatever it was. When I finished school, I studied a Bachelor of Building Management and Property Economics and worked as a client-side project manager for 7 years. That's where I met you. I think you were working at Yunkin, however you pronounce it.
Yep.
So that's how I had your contact details. And then I left that gig and worked for a developer for a year and a half as a development manager and senior project manager. And then I thought, well, I don't want to fight with subbies or contractors anymore. I don't want to deal with council anymore. What can I do? I need to get into some sort of sales. I forgot to mention at the same time, probably 4 years into my construction role as a side gig, I started a footwear label called Fane Footwear, men's loafers, boat shoes, belts, brogues, etc. And it kind of blew up. It was just a side gig, but I opened a store in Paddington, a store in Westfield, Sydney. I was selling online on the Iconic. So it was great. I was kind of juggling both. And then I was kind of deciding what to do. And I thought, do I get into real estate? Do I get into recruitment? Or do I get into mortgage broking? And I thought, I know too many real estate agents, half my mates are. Recruitment, I went for a trial for a day or two and just wasn't for me. And then I found Theo Chambers, a friend of mine who founded and started Shore Financial, and met up with him and thought, this is great. Finance combined with sales, combined with property, and don't look back. It's almost been 8 years and it's been fantastic.
It's funny because I can't imagine you doing anything. Like, I'm not Shane the Foo guy. Shane the Shoe guy is what I meant to say. Like, to me, you're the face of, you're the epitome of mortgage broking. Like, you're totally the guy who has got the insights, who knows what's happening, how to get stuff done, and how, like, it seems odd that you'd be anywhere else. Like, I can't. And I almost forgot that, you know, we had a connection before that. I actually forgot about that.
Yeah. So, well, how we got talking for finance is I took my 500 contacts in my phone and Outlook and send a mail blast to everybody to say, I'm now a mortgage broker. I can help you with your finance. And you responded and said, great, what can we do? So that's how we connected again.
Yeah. And I guess the thing that I love is that you actually provide, I guess, because I've spoken to mortgage brokers, I've dealt with mortgage brokers, I've dealt with banks. It's very opaque and weird. Like, or you unpack it and explain it. And that's why I've kind of dealt with you a lot, because you actually explain it, all the crazy stuff that you experience that you don't understand why you're filling in all these forms and where it's all going. You've actually, that's why I thought of you, you know, for Buildopedia. Like, I'm like the perfect guy, because you can explain all the nonsensical things that happen when you start talking to a bank, and all, you know, that whole sort of Ferris wheel of bullshit that you go through. You actually unpack it and go, here's what we do. And it comes down to something that's a recurring theme. It's about a narrative and demonstrating to a bank. So it's not just a matter of inputs. It's actually constructing a narrative and showing a bank that you're worthy of credit. You can make payments, and it's about presenting a totality. And I think that's, if there's one thing I've learned from you, that it's more than just numbers and ticking boxes. It's actually presenting something.
Yeah, you've taken the words out of my mouth. That was something I was probably going to touch on. I mean, if we kind of jump through a bit of the script, but yeah, absolutely. Some people say, why go to a mortgage broker? Why don't I just go direct to my bank? Is you kind of get one shot, and it's important to know how to present it to the bank so that they understand it. It goes through as streamlined as possible, and there's no red flags that is going to cause a decline or reduce borrowing capacity, et cetera. So like you said, there is a narrative to every client and deal.
Like one thing that I always knew, but I never knew the reason for. So what is the main reason why you only go to one bank? What, you can't really just shop around. You said just then you get one shot. And I think that's important for, I guess, listeners to know. It's not something you can just apply for. It's not like home insurance where you just can get quotes from 20 different places and choose the one that you want to go with. So just talk us through that kind of system.
That's exactly right. Because like you said, home insurance, you can just apply and get a quote as such. But for a bank to look at it, you actually need to go through an application and lodge it, and it hits your credit file, and then they pick it up and they assess it. So you can't really exactly get a truthful answer if you go to a bank without doing that. Not to sell myself, but as a mortgage broker, we know what the banks look for. We use the same calculators they do. We use the same income assessment. So I can confidently say to you, all right, based on your income and your assets and your liabilities, this is how much you'll be able to borrow. This is the rate we can get. And 99% of the time when we lodge it, we get it through. Of course, if there's any red flags, bad credit, you didn't disclose a liability, you may have missed some payments, you may have an outstanding tax debt or things like that. But if everything is clean cut and truthful as what you presented to us, we generally get it through very, very well and clean.
One question that a friend of mine asked, because we were talking about this the other day, and one of the things is a lot of things are very opaque when you deal with banks. One of them is actually knowing what interest rate you're paying. And a friend of mine who will remain anonymous went to get her refinance recently and could not find an interest rate anywhere on her file, had to really work it back from scratch. So there's a lot of things that are like banks, they're very, I guess, highly regulated, but they really try and hone in on the things that are open to them. And in some cases, really try and they have to disclose some things, but they obscure other things. I guess, is that normal not to know what your interest rate even is?
Not really, to be honest. You should know, but in this market where we've had so many rate rises and it's fluctuating on a monthly basis, it can get lost because maybe your statements are only quarterly or biannually rather than monthly or updated, depending on which lender it is. It may not reflect what the rate is, but each time a statement's issued, it should show what the interest rate is as of that date. But depends what lender you're with. Maybe it will only show it every 6 months, or every 3 or 4 months type thing.
Or maybe you have to have a statement. Most people just, I guess, look it up through their online portal or their internet banking. So yeah, it probably is on a statement, but, you know, most people just go in through their phone, and it actually seems tricky to find that sort of information.
Which is most important.
Which is most important, but it's hard to find it in a way where you normally go in to do your banking, which is probably mobile. But anyway, I guess the last time we chatted, one of the funny things that happened was that you told me the interest rates were leveling off, and the very next day they went up. So what's happening? Like, where are interest rates headed as of recording, which is in start of June 2023? What's happening? Where are we heading?
Well, fortunately, I didn't put that in writing because nobody has this crystal ball, so it's very hard to tell what rates are going to do. If you look at the curve, it's basically a V curve. Rates were up here circa 4.5%, 5% about 8 years ago. Then they gradually dropped and then dipped to all-time lows during COVID, and we were spoiled for a good 2 years. And now COVID and the economy is trying to recover, so they're now climbing up. We're only about a percentage higher than where rates were at about 4 or 5 years ago. Everybody's obviously kicking and screaming about that, but it's because we were spoiled for a few years that everybody wanted rates at 2% or sub 2, and now we're looking at rates in mid fives to sixes. What's my prediction and my projection? So basically, The RBA has been increasing rates over the last 12 months to curb inflation, but that obviously may satisfy or resolve one issue, but it may cause other issues such as mortgage stress, higher payments, etc. So in the last 12 months, we've had 11 rate rises. The cash rate has gone from 0.1%, so almost at zero, up to 3.85%. So it's more than tripled. And as you can appreciate, every bank passes that on. None of them have held back. So all banks have passed that on. So rates have gone from circa 2% to 5.5%, 6%. There was a pause in April, and we thought, all right, this is where they're going to start curbing and rates will maybe plateau. And then we had another rate rise in May, which came as a shock to absolutely everybody and obviously is causing more mortgage stress to clients out there. What are our thoughts, or I guess what are economists' thoughts that we're piggybacking off, is they're probably predicting maybe one or two more rate rises at max, so perhaps up to 50 basis points. Then they would suggest that rates are going to plateau for maybe the next 6 or 8 months and then hopefully start dropping early next year. When will they start dropping? By how much they'll start dropping? None of us know, but we would obviously hope that when they start dropping, it's not 25 or 50 basis points. We see a good one, maybe 1.5% to help people, because as you can appreciate, as rates have gone up, people's mortgage repayments have gone up. But if your repayments have tripled, your income hasn't tripled over the last year or two. So it's definitely causing mortgage stress. We're worried about this huge wave of fixed rates that are going to roll off. So they're suggesting that there's $375 billion worth of fixed rates that are due to roll off from May over the next 12 months. And those are some people that may roll off from as low as 1.79%. And then all of a sudden their loan is about 5.5%. How are they going to be able to afford that? And to even add to that, if they were on interest only and that interest only was then rolling off to P&I, it's kind of a double impact effect where your payments are increasing because of the conversion from interest only to P&I, but also the rate is tripling. So it's quite scary. I don't think we've felt the ripple effect yet. I think there's definitely going to be a little bit of, I hate to say, doom and gloom, because some people may have to be forced to sell their homes. Some people may decide to offload some investment properties just to reduce the mortgage stress and load. Another thing is, as rates go up, borrowing capacity goes down. So as rates have gone up over the last 12 months, borrowing capacity has dropped by about 35%. So if you could borrow $1 million a year ago, you can only maybe borrow about 700,000 or 650 around that if your income hasn't increased significantly. So the issue with that is new purchasers now have to reduce the proposed purchase price, and the property market definitely hasn't dropped by those levels. And it's created this sense of mortgage jail where people who want to refinance actually can't, because when we run the numbers and the banks assess it, they're not actually able to service the existing debt that they have, let alone more or new debt.
Yeah, so that makes it a lot harder to shop around at the moment. And yeah, I can, but so people are kind of stuck by default, I guess. They don't have that luxury that a lot of people, including myself, have had, where you can look around for a better deal at any time. And if your banks, does that set up the banks to kind of be a bit more hard ass, for lack of a better term, because they have people trapped a little bit?
Yes and no, because at the end of the day, there's so many lenders out there. You know, we've got 45 plus or minus lenders on our panel that we can go to. And at the end of the day, for instance, say CBA wants to start rubbing their hands together and capitalizing on people not being able to refinance, they're going to lose a huge amount of business because people start going to St. George and Macquarie and whoever else isn't doing that. So they have to kind of keep it on par to do the right thing. What we're doing, what I've actually done, is I've hired a full-time post-settlement person that basically is going through my entire book of clients and repricing their existing loans to see if we can bring the rates down. Because even though the cash rate has gone up and the standard variable rate has gone up, what banks have kind of done is they've increased the discount off the standard variable rates. So that means if your discount was, say, 2% and your rate was sitting now at 6.5%, we know we can get 2.5% or even 3% off. So we simply reprice it with the same bank, send it into the bank, and your rate then drops from, say, 6% to 5.5%. No cost, no application form. But the banks aren't going to voluntarily call you to say, hey, Matt, by the way, you're on 6%. Should we bring that down to 5 or 5.5? But we're all across that to firstly retain you as clients, but also make sure you're on the best wicket because we know that this mortgage stress is impacting everybody.
Well, can you do that while do you have to test your serviceability, I guess, is the question I'm asking. You do that, so if you're staying with the same bank, you can ask, how do you do that if you're not one of Fane's clients? Can you ask, hit your bank up for a discount? Like, how does that work?
Correct. So if you're not one of my clients as such and you're with, I'll use Commonwealth again, you'll have to go to Commonwealth directly and say, can you give me a discount? The only thing is, they may offer you 2.5% off and you may think, well, that's great. But we know that St. George and ANZ and Macquarie are offering, you know, another 50 basis points. So without that client knowing that there's better out there, they'll accept what CBA are offering. However, if it was our client, we would then go to CBA and say, well, St. George is offering this, ANZ's offering this, you need to match this or we're going to go elsewhere. And all of a sudden they'll drop their rate a little bit further.
Apart from serviceability, how have lending standards changed? Like, it feels like, serviceability aside, it's harder for, I guess, our clients to get finance. Is that the case? Have the rules changed? But interest rate rises aside, what are the differences between now and, say, the market 5 years ago?
Good question. So, yes, there is a lot more red tape than from 5 years ago, that's for sure. Kind of got very strict maybe 3-4 years ago. It hasn't gotten worse since COVID or since all of these rate rises, except, of course, serviceability has dropped. But you've basically got your parameters and what the banks require, and there's no real way of getting around that. Obviously, there's policy exceptions, but they do ask for certain docs, and as long as you tick those off, then you'll satisfy the requirements. Where it's a bit harder is for self-employed. You know, if you've just started a business, your ABN's only been registered for 6 months and you don't even have 1 year of financials, you're not going to be able to get a loan through a major bank or a mainstream lender. We've got smaller second and third tier lenders on our panel that will take 6 months ABN, have a look at what they call a low doc loan, where you can get an accountant's declaration, 6 months business bank account statements, or 6 months BAS, annualize it, and that's the figure that they'll adopt for borrowing capacity. Yes, they'll charge a higher fee, but it at least gets your foot in the door. You look at it as a stepping stone or a blended rate as such, because you may pay a rate 2 or 3% higher than what the main banks are offering, do that for a year, maybe 2 years, then you've got your financials in order, and then you refinance to a major bank. Because all major banks require generally your ABN registered for a minimum of 2 years and at least 1 full year of financials. So the self-employed part is tricky.
So is that the red tape that you were referring to that was added 3.5 years ago? Is it self-employed, or what other red tape has been added to the system that we're maybe not really knowing about?
So in terms of red tape that the banks have put on over the, say, last 3 or 4 years, is basically they've introduced a minimum HEMS, which means minimum living expenses. So 8-10 years ago, you could put any figure and the bank will adopt it. You could put $1,000 a month. Now the banks have qualified you according to your income, according to your status. Are you married or single? And do you have any dependents? And then based on that, there'll be a minimum level of living expenses that have to be applied. So even though you may put $2,000 a month, the bank may say, no, we have calculated it's about $3,500 a month. So yeah, even if you can prove that through bank statements and supporting documents, bank will still adopt that higher figure as such.
And so what's the other bit of red tape that you're referring to?
So the other red tape is banks have what they call an assessment rate, which is a buffer above the actual interest rate. So if your interest rate is 5%, the buffer used to be only maybe 1 or 2%. Don't quote me on that. They increase that to 3%. So when they're working out your borrowing capacity, they want you to be able to service a loan 3% higher than the real rate. should your income drop, should you have another child, should rates go up. So that's what's really impacted borrowing capacity as such. If I kind of pivot, because something I wanted to talk about, what banks, the Westpac Group and a few other lenders have introduced a new refinance, which they've called a streamlined process, where for refinances, for principal and interest repayments only, for clients looking to refinance to bring their rates down, they're allowing that buffer to drop back down to 1% rather than 3%. And that's now opening the door to allow more refinances. Because I've had a dozen or two dozen clients over the last 6 months that have come to me to refinance. And when I run the numbers, they can't actually afford their existing debt. So now with this new policy, it's opening up the doors to them.
And apart from that, I guess there has been a change in a part of lending that I'm sort of familiar with, because I'm in architecture and construction. Obviously, through the COVID sort of innate or the COVID resultant price escalation and instability in the market, we've gone from ubiquitous kind of fixed price contracts with some cost plus contracts, whereas now that needle has flipped. And I know you were telling me that CBA have actually changed their policy around cost plus contracts in terms of construction loans. So how is that sort of landscape changing to accommodate, I guess, a change in the contract landscape and a change in like construction fundamentals and instability?
Yeah, great question. So majority of banks want a fixed lump sum building contract with an independent contractor. Then they weren't, and majority of them aren't really interested in cost plus, and they aren't really interested or don't really have an appetite for owner builders as such. A lot of clients obviously want to try to do cost plus, especially in this market where building costs have really jumped 30, 40%. You'll know better than me. Someone like CBA have introduced cost plus contracts for contracts of $1 million and above only. It's a bit more tedious, a lot more paperwork, same pricing and same process. But what happens is your builder essentially will have to provide dozens of receipts for that month or that period, tally them up, send them to the bank. The bank will have a look at it. They may send their quantity surveyor out to have a look at the works versus the actual invoices or receipts themselves, and then will pay accordingly. So it's a lot more controlled by the bank. And obviously they have to consider whatever the builder's margin is on it. I wouldn't even know these days. I'd imagine probably 15, 20% on top of the actual cost itself. So it is doable. Majority of banks don't offer it. CBA is the main one that do. But generally the appetite is fixed lump sum building contracts and independent contractor, not owner builder.
And that tends to put the squeeze on normal, like not many people, I guess, in the context of market share, there's probably not many people spend over $1 million on a renovation or a new house as a percentage of the overall market. But I guess it puts the squeeze on builders and inadvertently puts the squeeze on homeowners, because in our company, Ballast Point, essentially we've given owners the choice. We've given them a cost plus rate, an open book rate, and then we said, we can fix it, but here's the margin to fix it. And we've just, because we got a bit caught up in the conversation around which contract, we've just thrown it open. We said, well, you choose. But yeah, you're right. Like cost plus normally is 15 to maybe 20 or 25% for very small jobs. But when you want us to fix the price, there's a risk premium on that. And in the current market where cost escalation has been up to 20% per annum, it has to be a 20% risk margin for cost escalation, as well as just general construction risk, because on a lump sum project, you do carry some construction risk. Of course, like there are things excluded, like late conditions and things that you can't anticipate, but other things that go wrong on a typical construction job, you just have to cover if you've got a lump sum contract. So yeah, most clients tend to favor cost plus when they're actually told the real cost, you know, And the interesting thing about that is that when you look at the data, the research data, that kind of follows the spread anyway. Lump sum contracts do attract a margin of something like 30% as a rule or more. So it's kind of putting the squeeze on the owners as well, because they're having to fund a risk premium on behalf of the bank, I guess. The bank doesn't want to take any risk. It's passed on to the builder. The builder charges the owner for it, unless the, you know, the builder's been caught out and they've signed the contract not anticipating the cost escalation. Yeah, yeah, material, but labor generally. But if you're a homeowner trying to finance construction, what are your other options?
Great question. Something I wanted to talk about. So there are a few options. So the easiest way is, depends on the extent of the job, but say it's just a 500K renovation job. The best way is to do a cash out or top up loan to your existing mortgage. The only issue with that is you need to make sure you've got enough equity in your property in order to borrow that amount, plus serviceability, of course, because say your property's worth $2 million and your loan's 1.6, you're already at 80%. So you can't really borrow much more. Or if you do, you're going to go into lenders' mortgage insurance territory. But if there is enough equity in it, then doing a cash out is great, because you get the funds in your account, you control those funds, you make the payments, there's no bank intervention as such. But on the contrary, the bank then won't take the upside of the cash out funds to the property. So they won't all of a sudden say, oh, well, once you do the reno, the property is going to be worth $2.5 million. So we'll lend you the 500K. So if that isn't possible, then you go down to a construction loan, which work fine, but ultimately the bank is in control of the loan itself. So you've got to get all your documentation in, your DA approval, your stamp plans, your fixed lump sum building contract. They've even got a progress drawdown schedule, which can't be too heavy in the front, can't be front loaded. They control it, etc. But in a way, it is in the benefit of the client, because they're managing risk as well. So though, you know, if you're not a builder as such and you're just an individual looking to do a renovation or a construction job, you don't know if you're overpaying or underpaying. So the bank at least controls that for you. And to take a one step further, they at least managing the risk that if, God forbid, the builder goes bust or you have to kick the builder off the job, that they haven't overpaid, so that when they need to get a new contractor on site, there's enough funds in the kitty to cover the remainder of the project. And that, I guess, then moves on to my next thing. So if you can't get your loan with a major bank or the borrowing capacity, we do work closely with a lot of private lenders who have much less red tape, much easier to deal with. However, they are a lot more costly, but we can then procure the finance with them because it's purely asset lent rather than borrowing capacity lent. So it's easier to get it over the line at a higher rate. But if you're happy to pay a bit of a premium in interest, that's one way to get around and do it. And the other thing is if you're on a site and for some reason you can't continue with that builder or you run out of funds, no mainstream lender will take over an already half-funded project as such. They'll just will wipe their hands clean of it. So if you're then stuck with your existing bank and you need more funding, then the option is to go to a private funder who can sort it out. Yes, it's a premium, but you'll get the job done at least.
And what happens if you've got a construction loan, but construction contracts are limited to things that are known at the time of signing the contract? So, and it's not unusual for ground conditions to be not what is expected by the builder or the engineer. And I mean, I've had this happen where the extreme example, we have had geotech done, and this was a site that I worked on many years ago in Whale Beach, and we had geotech done, we had engineering done, and just by luck, as we've excavated through sandstone, we got to the basement level, we've run out of sandstone, we've hit soft shale or whatever underneath. So suddenly there's, in that case, it's almost impossible to predict, because a geotech just tells you where rock is. It doesn't tell you where the rock runs out below you. I don't know if I'm painting a good picture, but imagine digging through bedrock and digging down to the basement and running out of bedrock, punching through the bottom and finding that actually you've hit the next layer and it's soft. And we've gone from just sitting the building on a simple slab to then peering down into the soft shale, and that added at least $100,000. So there are things that happen in the course of construction that nobody can predict. So what do you do when obviously you've got a lump sum contract with a builder? That's obviously an extra that nobody could have predicted. So you're going to have to pay for that. That's the risk you take on as an owner or a developer. What do you do when you've got a construction loan and a fixed contract that needs to be extended? Does the bank have a buffer in a fixed price contract?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you've got to take into account latent conditions or variations. So yeah, for something like that, because there's a difference between building a home or renovating a home and doing a proper construction project with basements, et cetera, where there's more risk because you're going deeper in the ground. So yeah, there'll definitely be some sort of contingency. I believe the bank would insist on minimum 10%, but maybe on the risk or size of the project, they may insist on 15% contingency. So at least you can try counteract some of those latent conditions and variations.
So you've kind of gone to the end of the job, and if you've run out of money because of latent conditions or other factors, I mean, every project has provisional sums and decisions are made and things are done. So there is a built-in buffer is what you're saying.
There has to be 15%.
Yeah. So you approach the bank to say, hey, we need a little bit more. And they probably, I guess, from what you're saying, they factor that into when they're assessing the loan in the first instance. Is that right?
Yeah, they would have to, because like I said, if it's just a house, there's obviously less of a contingency, less risk, etc. You're more talking about development finance, which yes, there'll definitely be more contingency factored into the buffer. They definitely wouldn't allow it to just pass marginally, so that if on say a $3 million construction job, they wouldn't allow that expect only say 50 or 100 grand worth of variations, that maybe expect more so $300,000 to $500,000 to cover that contingency as such before they approve and award that loan.
Oh yeah, and I mean, things you just never know what you're going to dig up on any house. It doesn't have to be a development site. I mean, I did a project in Bondi that was just a house, and it wasn't anything elaborate, but we demolished the garage slab of the existing house, found another slab underneath that the old builder had buried, and then underneath that was the most enormous pile of asbestos that I've ever seen. So you never know. It was a simple demo. It went from a very contaminated site that was again, no sign of it. It was buried underneath, you know, two layers of concrete. But yeah, every project, simple house or reno, there are things that do move.
Yeah. And of course, then you've got the joys of explaining to the client. The client isn't happy, but it's not your fault. So you're in trouble. Then the client's in trouble with the bank. And it's kind of a vicious circle, but it's the unpredictable.
Yeah. And I guess my experience is that banks are more forgiving than people presume when they're going in, so that they are known to put things on hold, that there's more of a buffer. And I'm saying that from a perspective of saying to people, just because you miss one payment, the bank's not going to foreclose on you. There is buffers and levers there. You're not, you know, as much as people think they might be in mortgage stress, the last thing the bank wants to do is probably repossess your house.
Spot on. That's exactly right. When COVID hit, they offered everyone this COVID pause, where essentially you could pause your repayments for, I think it was 6 months, and then you could extend it for another 6 months from memory. But obviously that was helping get through those times, but the bank then simply added whatever those repayments would have been for the 6 or 12 months onto the loan. And then once you started paying again, your repayments increased. But like you said, the banks aren't in the business of repossessing houses. It's more costly to them and more, I guess, contract administrating to them to do that. So there is leeway, but if you've got missed payments or poor conduct and you're looking to refinance to another lender, that's really kind of frowned upon and can make it harder for another lender to take on your business, because they sort of see, oh, well, if you can't handle the mortgage now with Bank X, why do we want to bring you on knowing you're going to miss payments or be late or whatever it is? So that's something important to note, to keep your your conduct clean at all times when you're applying for finance.
Absolutely. And I think it's important, like if you can't make a payment, you do approach the bank, correct me if I'm wrong, you do preempt it and you pause it rather than missing a payment. And that, I think, and again, I might be wrong, you tell me, but I think that makes all the difference in terms of your assessment down the track. If you do pause it, but then resume it, the thing to do is resume it when you told them you're going to resume it. And I don't know that pausing, or does pausing count towards your credit?
There isn't really the offer to pause, or touch wood, I haven't really had those issues with clients. There was the pause during COVID because that was a massive pandemic affecting everybody not being able to work and bringing income, etc. But to just call the bank and say, hey, it's been a slow week or a slow month, is it okay if I don't pay you? Haven't heard of. No, that will be an arrears, and then they'll want you to make that payment as soon as possible.
Yeah, sure. Okay, and what are the other secret hacks? What are the other things that you can tell us that the banks don't want us to know?
I can't spill the beans too much because I don't want to get myself on the chopping block, but a few important things is keep your conduct as clean as possible, reduce your liabilities, keep your living expenses low, and obviously your credit in check when applying for finance, whether it's a refinance, construction finance, or whatever it is. One little trick of the trade, though, that I'd like to share with you is, say you're purchasing a property, you own your home and you've got a loan of $1 million on it, then you want to go and purchase an investment property. When we do the calculations and the bank calculates it, they factor in that $1 million debt and that works against you. However, a trick is if you purchase a property in a trust, so let's call it Trust A, for instance, and you borrow $500,000, if you then go and purchase another property in, say, Trust B, someone like Macquarie Bank, and this is the actual policy, this isn't a trick, this is actual policy, will not include or factor in the debts held in Trust A because they assume that that's a trust, it's a company, and they can handle their own debt. So they only look at the debts in your new Trust B. So essentially, you can just keep borrowing and borrowing, provided you're purchasing in non-discretionary trusts that are non-trading and purely set up for the purpose of purchasing property. So the only thing you need is basically enough equity or enough capital to inject to cover the 20% plus stamp duty. So if you've got, you know, $1 million and your borrowing capacity isn't that strong, but it's strong enough to, say, withhold a $500K loan, you can keep purchasing 4, 5, maybe 6 properties in different trusts with someone like Macquarie Bank, because they're not going to include all the debt. They're only going to include the new debt in the new trust. And some major banks also do that, but that's a bit of a loophole and a trick of the trade, and it's kind of case by case whether you get that through or not.
So let me just unpack that a little bit. So you've got your own house, you've got a mortgage, you need to pull out some equity initially so you need 20% of the new purchase, but that each trust is assessed separately, but they're not assessed cumulatively. Is that
correct?
Is that what we're saying? Yeah.
Exactly. So the bank will still factor in your personal debts, but they won't factor in the debts in your trust. So provided with your personal debts, say for your owner-occupied home, there's enough borrowing capacity to keep that, say, $1 million loan, plus a $500K loan in the trust. Essentially, you can just keep doing that over and over.
Although at some point, you're assuming that the return, the rental return, covers your repayments. Otherwise, you're going to run out of repayments.
Yeah, spot on.
But I guess, is there a minimum value that that's worth doing for, given that you've got to set up a trust and jump through some hoops? And is there a point at which you wouldn't bother?
Good question. Don't quote me, but I think the cost to set up a trust is maybe $3,000-$3,500. But, you know, if you're purchasing for, say, $500K, you're hoping that the capital growth, I don't know, 10% a year type thing, depending on how the market's doing, that far outweighs a one-off $3,500 upfront cost as such. I wouldn't be buying something, you know, for $100,000 or $200,000 or $300,000 out in wherever, but maybe make it a minimum, say, $500,000 or $600,000, and then it's probably worth your while.
Well, that's a great hack. What else? Come on, you got to have some sneaky. One of the sneaky things you can do is if your partner has a house or you have someone to rely on, you can, in effect, buy a property based on an investment property. If you move into that property in a year or two, well, the bank really doesn't know or won't know. Is that too, am I going too far, Fane?
No, that's correct. But, you know, as compliance, if I know a client's purchasing an owner-occ, but they just decide, hey, we're going to make an investment so we can use the rental income to get it to service, I generally wouldn't be happy to write that loan because it's going to come back to me. But you are right in the sense that people's purpose do change. You know, I bought my first property, I moved into it. 6 months later, I did rent it out because I could fetch a really good rental yield, and I decided to rent where I was living and sort of became a rent vester, and it worked out really well. So it does change, and that is an option. But we try keep things clean cut. You know, if we don't want to massage it too much because it's only going to come back on us. And the last thing we want is it works based on the rental income, but all of a sudden they move in, there's no rental income and they can't afford the loan. Obviously, if servicing is extremely strong and they are going to move in, they're not going to move in, it's a different ball game. So yeah, that is something that can help and can assist. A few other tricks. I mean, you know, if you are self-employed and you've just started a business or your tax returns aren't done yet, then going down the low-doc road can work well because an accountant can sign a declaration based on what your current income is, even though tax returns aren't done. So that can really help with borrowing capacity. Or if you've had a really good last 6 months in business, but the last year or so wasn't good, they'll annualize your last 6 months based on business bank statements or 6 months worth of BAS and use that figure for borrowing capacity. So that can certainly assist.
And what is the low-doc premium, I guess? What? Because, I mean, from what I've seen at times, it can be reasonable. Other times, it can be absolutely brutal. It can almost be credit card rates, you know?
Yeah. Depending on lenders, they're at about maybe 1.5% to about 2-2.5% higher than what we're getting at the banks. And depending on the LVR, depending on the lender, there may be a risk fee of anywhere from 0.5% to 1.5%, just a one-off fee. But again, if you look at the opportunity cost of getting your foot in the door and being able to acquire that property, which will hopefully be growing capital gains as such, growth over a certain period of time, to spend an extra $5,000 or $10,000 in interest for a couple of years compared to that property growing by 50, 100K is a no-brainer. So they're not that much more expensive, but it depends on how low doc you need to go and what your situation is. You know, if you've had a bankruptcy, the business is only registered 6 months ago, your credit is not great, and you're borrowing at 80 or maybe 90% LVR, you're going to be hit pretty hard. But if it's quite vanilla for low doc, then you're only going to look at maybe 1.5% higher than current bank rates.
Cool. All right. Well, is there anything that I should have asked you that I haven't asked you yet?
I think we've covered all of it, but one other little trick is when refinancing, consolidating debts can really help. You know, you get your car loan, which is at a rate of, I don't know, 6-7%, maybe even higher now, 8-9% over a 3 or 5 year period. You've got your credit card debts. You may even have a tax debt, you know, which is costing you $4,000 or $5,000 a month type thing. If there's enough equity in your property for you to refinance and roll all of those debts into the mortgage, it's a no-brainer because you'll be at, say, 5.5% as of today, and over a 30-year term, it's going to make a huge difference. You know, instead of paying $5,000 a month, just for instance, on those debts, it may bring it down to as low as $1,000 a month, which is a huge saving. So consolidating debts into your mortgage is definitely a good trick, a way to consolidate all your expenses and keep it neat so that you're not kind of struggling unnecessarily on high interest.
Yeah, absolutely. And if people want your help to refinance, where do they go?
Easy. They can give me a call. Well, you know, you can share my details. They can send me an email. I guess I haven't really explained, but just very quickly, as a mortgage broker, so we're essentially bringing business to the banks. So we've got 45 lenders on our panel. We don't charge a fee or service. So it's a free service to the clients. we get remunerated by the banks in the form of a commission, and all banks basically pay the same. Some of the private funders or low-doc lenders may pay a little bit more, but essentially we shop it around, we negotiate the rates, we squeeze the banks down because we present to them what other banks are presenting, and obviously for them to win the business, they have to match. And then we handle the whole process. So we'll prepare the application documents, send them to you to review and sign. We'll lodge the app. Myself and my team will manage the app. We'll answer any queries from the bank. Obviously, anything we don't know, then we'll reach out to you to clarify that. Once it's approved, we'll send you the approval, send you the e-docs, hopefully, and get it done. So we try and make it as streamlined as possible. Yes, in the beginning, we ask for a lot of information, but that's what the bank's going to ask you anyway. So we sort of hit it on the front end, get all the docs together. Once you've got all of that to us, it's pretty smooth and streamlined.
Yeah, and my hack is just fill in, because there's nothing worse in my life than filling in paperwork. And I always just have found, well, you and Shore Financial just amazing with helping with that and just making it simpler. Because it is, when I think about filling in another bank form, makes me feel ill. And you guys really do help with that. So
it's a tedious process. One thing that we've done since the last time I helped you with your loans, because I used to email you a Word document or PDF to fill in, we've now got a client portal where we send you a link, you log in online, you fill in your info, it automatically saves so you can do it today, tomorrow, whenever you find time. And it saves that info. And the beauty about that is then, when we do the data entry, it halves the time because that data is extracted and pulled straight to the application. But more importantly, if you come back to us 6, 12 months, a few years later for a refinance or a top-up, all your info's there. So you just log in again and amend it. So it's not starting from scratch. You upload all the supporting docs to the portal and then we deal with it. So we've even streamlined it since, I guess, me and you worked together a few years ago.
Yeah, and that's brilliant because sometimes in the course of one interaction with the bank, you're filling in the same thing over and over again. That's my memory. And sometimes you wonder, like, is anyone even going to read this bit? My policy in filling out forms is I put my name and hope for the best and let someone tell me that I've missed something.
Yeah.
But look, I really appreciate your time. I guess three takeaways from today. One is, If you need finance, if you need refinancing, talk to Fane.
Please.
That's my recommendation. One of the most effective people I've ever dealt with in any industry, to be honest. But what are the other takeaways?
I would say, I mean, if you haven't reviewed your home loan in the past 12 months, you should do so immediately and speak to us because we can negotiate and sharpen your rates either with your existing lender or look to refinance you to a new lender. I guess going through a mortgage broker, and again, not to sell myself, is just easier than going to the bank directly because the bank's not going to tell you, don't show this piece of information or make sure you clean up your credit, et cetera. They're going to look at it as of then when you're lodging it. Whereas we'll look at it, if your credit's not good, we'll say, you know what, let's revisit this in 3 months when your credit's better and we can get a better shot of getting it over the line.
And I would add an effective mortgage broker because, oh my God, there is such a spread between the capabilities of one broker and another. And I can recommend Fane, but certainly if you don't like Fane, get a recommendation. Like don't just go into the yellow pages to find, you know, don't Google mortgage broker. There is such a gap between the capabilities of one firm and another and one broker and another. So definitely get a recommendation. Don't deal with banks. It's awful. Yeah. Get a broker. Either take my recommendation or find someone who recommends someone to you who's appropriate or who you're comfortable with. But yeah, don't Google it. It's awful. I've seen it.
One takeaway I just thought of is, I think we're at the real top of where rates are at. So if you're feeling the pinch right now, I think there is light at the end of the tunnel because they can't possibly go that much higher. And I'm really hopeful, and so is, you know, my team and I guess the general industry, that rates will start coming down next year. So if you're handling it now, you should be good to go in the next 12 months and hopefully feel a little bit of relief coming your way.
Yeah, but if you're struggling, talk to your bank. That's my advice. Don't just miss payments. Talk to your bank. Definitely. Tell them what's happening. Tell them where you're at and get their advice. But Fane, thanks so much.
Yeah,
I know you're really busy and I know you've taken a big chunk out of your day. So I'm really appreciative. Thanks for being here and thanks for all your help over the years as well.
No, it's been my pleasure. It's been a good journey working with you. And of course, I appreciate you inviting me onto this podcast. I hope the listeners and you guys at least got a bit of insight and a bit of knowledge from it. And yeah, I'm always accessible if you ever need to reach out.
Yeah, so big thank you. Thanks to all our listeners. And yeah, we'll have some material and some links. And if you want to get in touch with Fane, you can. And make sure you join our community by signing up to our mailing list. And we'll have links in the show notes. Thank you and bye for now.
You've been listening to Buildopedia. Please remember to like us and share our episode with your friends. We'd love your comments and suggestions. And we have a new website, buildopedia.au, where you can get in touch or leave a question and check out our blog.